capitals to intertwine together to bet on what was right. Syria has borne a lot of blame and clear Arab official pressure because of the position late President Hafez al-Assad took when he opened his arms to Imam Khomeini's Islamic Revolution in 1979 and stood by Iran during the 8-year Iraqi war against the Islamic Republic. The Arab regime's ally to the colonialists never forgot that position. Not because of jealousy over Iraq, of course, but because the Syrian-Iranian alliance that developed over the subsequent years to form a practical axis of resistance in the region included all Arab and Islamic movements against the colonialists and the forces of hegemony, up to the defeat of the Israeli enemy in southern Lebanon in the year 2000 at the hands of the most prominent Arab resistance force that arose from the womb of this axis. Because this alliance was and still is posing a great danger to the forces of dependence and surrender associated with the projects of Western powers in West Asia. Therefore, when the Western war on Syria began in 2011, Tehran did not delay a single moment in joining Damascus in its war, in which it was intended to destroy the last Arab country that said no to colonialists and raised the matter of resistance and liberation in its face. Iran quickly entered the field through military advisors, trainers, and volunteer popular groups that were sponsored, trained, and armed by the Iranian state to fight side by side with the Syrian Arab army and unite with them in a baptism of blood that moved this alliance to a new level of brotherhood on the long and grueling road of resistance. For all this, President Raisi's visit comes in its official form, duration, and the way it was received in the Syrian capital from the airport to the People's Palace as an explicit declaration of the victory of this alliance, which is led by Tehran and Damascus over one of the most dangerous projects that targeted the two countries and the region for decades. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Iranian presidential plane landed in Damascus last week carrying President Ibrahim Raisi accompanied by a large government delegation in the first visit of an Iranian president to Syria in 13 years. The timing of the visit seems to be the most important of all without diminishing the importance of the agreements signed between the two countries and the transition of cooperation between them to economically advanced stages after its security and political contract was completed during the years of the war. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Laith, to discuss this very important visit to Damascus. I mean, at the height of the moment of Arab openness towards the Syrian capital, Damascus, the visit of the Iranian president, Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, to Damascus carried several messages in many different directions about the relationship between Syria and Iran, about Iran's position, basically, on the Syrian political map and the directions of cooperations ahead between both states in both the near and the far future. I am interested in learning what messages this visit sent, especially to the regional players.
Well, it clearly came out before the expected re-entry of Syria into the Arab League and before any peace treaty is signed between Turkey and Syria. So what does this mean? This means that the most important relationship that Syria has with any regional country is Iran, and this visit was a message to all the Arab countries that are trying to court Syria back into the Arab League and to create relations again. Remember, Syria has been in alliance with the Iran since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Syria has been offered billions of dollars and trade and taking off the sanctions if it gives up the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran over the last two decades since the war in Iraq that happened multiple times as offers from the United States. And today, as Syria emerges victorious from the global war on it, led by the United States and its local vessels, we see Syria reaffirming its relationship with Iran, that it will not move closer to Arab states or give up its relationship with Iran after all this war?
Well, I was interested in listening to what Syrian President Dr. Bashar Assad had to say when he received his Iranian counterpart. He basically said that when the war was launched against Syria 12 years ago, Iran did not hesitate to stand by Syria. And then he added that the two leaderships had bet on the victory of truth. And in the end, they both won that bet. But at what cost, though?
Well, obviously, the cost of resisting imperialism and occupation is very high. But the cost of surrendering to a colonizer, to an imperialist power like the United States, is even higher. We can see clearly what happened to Libya, what happened to Iraq, and what happened to any other country that gave up in the face of invasion. So Syria did pay a huge price for protecting its sovereignty and its dignity, but it definitely, that price was cheaper than being currently occupied by Wahhabi Contras or Israel or the United States directly. So this was the only choice in front of a Syria that wanted to stay sovereign.
Was it the only choice for Iran as well?
Of course it was the only choice for Iran. Remember, the United States, after its invasion of Iraq, had a plan to destroy seven countries in a row, and the last country in that list was Iran. And of course, the war of 2006 on Lebanon was to defeat Hezbollah. It was supposed to be followed by the war on Syria, as we saw, and for a crushing of Syria, for eventually Iran to be left alone in the region, and where Israel and the United States would attack it with its regional vessels. Of course, luckily, thanks to the perseverance and resistance of both Lebanese people and the Syrian people, that plan didn't come to fruition. And Iran today is safe because Syria was victorious, because Hezbollah was victorious.
Well, the Iranian visit came as a clear and direct response to the Israeli enemy as well, just like you just referred, which for years has been working towards the goal of expelling Iran from Syria in various direct and indirect ways. The most prominent of those methods that Israel played is the battle between wars policy, which aims in an essential part to create some sort of a discord between the Syrian and Iranian leadership. How do you see that Zionist war ending?
Well, the battle between wars, this Israeli strategy, is now completely failed. And of course, we saw in the last few weeks Syrian resistance firing missiles and throwing drones on the Golan Heights, occupied Golan Heights. We saw also resistance from Lebanon firing missiles on occupied North Palestine. And those were both indicators that the battle between wars strategy of Israel has failed and is coming to an end. Right now, the Israelis know that if they continue in this strategy of battle between wars, it will lead to a complete regional war. That's why, since that day, the Israelis are concentrating more on attacking Palestinians in the West Bank that are not as armed as the rest of the axis of resistance and are isolated because of the borders with Jordan. So this is what we can see as a holistic picture of the region. The more the axis of resistance gets integrated in its coordination, and the more, as we see, countries leave the American sphere, the more isolated Israel is, and the closer the end of that Zionist colony comes to be.
Well, definitely, and it is very interesting to see how things will develop for Syria, given that just a couple of days back, the Arab League also reinstated Syria into its stronghold, if you will. But for me, I see them coming back to Syria, not the other way around, because Syria has always remained where Syria is, with the resistance, with the Palestinian cause, and with the regional freedom and liberation of our peoples in West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Laith Ma'rouf, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this new phase of resistance in West Asia. Next, we will be talking about the unfortunate martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr Adnan in Israeli captivity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Martyr Khadr Adnan concluded his journey of pain, closing the record of his life full of struggle with an epic testimony in which he died of hunger, just as Imam Hussein died in the desert of Karbala thirsty. This world is a summer cloud, and when were the clouds a decision? This is what Martyr Khadr once shouted at his enemies at the top of his lungs, reassuring this time that his West Bank has recovered, opening the way for the free people after him to complete the path he paved for them. More details in this following report.
As soon as the occupation authorities announced last week that the leading captive of the Islamic Jihad movement, Khadr Adnan, had become a martyr after 86 days of hunger strike, the events in the Palestinian territories escalated between the firing of rockets from the Gaza Strip and shootings in the occupied West Bank. This was followed by widespread popular and factional condemnation, as well as a vow by the movement of captives in Zionist detention centers to launch a major hunger strike in rejection of the policy of administrative detention. In parallel, the Islamic Jihad and Hamas movements reached intensive contacts from mediators, during which they demanded that these two movements not respond to the assassination crime from the Gaza Strip and avoid a new military confrontation with the occupation during the current period. However, the resistance responded that the crime of assassinating Adnan will not pass without an appropriate response to it, with the aim of deterring the enemy and preventing it from repeating its crimes against the Palestinian captives. Indeed, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad held consultations about the nature of this response, which included parties in the axis of resistance, and as a result of the consultations, it was concluded that the initial response would be from the West Bank, which has so far witnessed two operations that resulted in the injury of three occupation soldiers, to be followed by responses from various arenas, including Gaza. It was not long before the Gaza Strip witnessed a series of tensions, which began with the firing of three missiles from the Strip towards the illegal settlements. These field developments were preceded by a series of positions condemning the assassination of Sheikh Khadr Adnan and threatening the enemy to pay the price, as the head of the political bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, made a call to the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad movement, Ziad al-Nakhale, in which he confirmed that the battle with the enemy is open. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in turn, mourned the martyr, saying that this crime calls for a serious and responsible national stand to deter the occupation and stop its crimes against the captive movement. Likewise, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine called for participation in activities of anger in the Palestinian West Bank, including Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, stressing that the Palestinian people will not forget their prisoners and their sacrifices. The assassination of Martyr Khadr Adnan will obviously not go unnoticed, because the Palestinian people will turn this crime into a nightmare that haunts Israel every day. Perhaps the best solution in the process of avenging the martyr is Martyr Adnan's own theory of unifying the internal Palestinian arenas, just like the regional axis of resistance. Meaning to not only count on the military response to avenge the martyr's assassination, but also destabilizing the enemy's security in all possible areas.
To discuss this issue with us from Toronto is Susanna Khalil. She's a politologist and researcher, columnist and activist, and founder of the Kanaan Association. Thank you very much, Ms. Susanna, for being with us. It's an honor to have you on the show. what the occupation forces did was a heinous assassination in front of the eyes of the entire world, and Israel has violated, as usual, all international conventions when it comes to the necessity of treating prisoners well and respecting their rights. I mean, they tortured the prisoner during his hunger strike, and they kept him in his cell despite his need for treatment, which they denied him, and they denied it during the time of his hunger strike. Did that surprise you in any way?
Thanks for having me. No, I'm not surprised. Quite the contrary. It is a colonial regime, and therefore that is proper of colonial bestiality against the native population. That is proof that the colonial regime of Israel is not a state, and even this colonialism is not a nation. It is a Eurocentric colonialism. It is a classic colonial anachronism. Now, concerning the administrative detention, euphemistic term, where the detainee without charge and the lawyers, for example, they have no access to any information, this is a violation. Even this is a violation of the international law, the code, the civil international code. So, and that we have to understand that we are not dealing with a state. We have to understand that we are dealing with a colonial regime that operates according its raison d'être. That is to say, it's conditioned as a colonial regime. In fact, they have openly say that the administration detention exists as a British mandate. So let's remember that the present colonialism in Palestine, called the so-called Israel, was thanks to the British colonialism, Europe. Therefore, I'm not at all surprised by this method of bestiality and brutality, which go beyond fascism, since we are today in 21st century and in front of a colonial anachronism.
Well, this past week, after the announcing of the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr Adnan, we witnessed an escalation in the field inside of Palestine on different various arenas. We had, for example, after the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr Adnan, after he had went on a hunger strike for 87 days, we saw an escalation in the form of operations against illegal colonial settlers in the occupied territories. We saw confrontations in the West Bank. Sadly, multiple martyrs, Palestinian martyrs, fell there as well, but also soldiers were wounded, occupation soldiers were wounded in that confrontation. And we saw missiles being launched from Gaza in retaliation to the assassination of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. How do you think the Zionist entity handled this form of escalation after some sort of a relative calm since the end of Ramadan until now?
Yes, I would like to speak about the Palestinian native, the freedom fighter Khadr Adnan Muhammad Musa. He was arrested 11 times, and he was in jail for 8 years, of course, in different periods. And he called for hunger strike 5 times. And the last time, his health was deteriorating, and the colonial regime of Israel denied any medical assistance. And Khadr Adnan is an inspiration that revive all the different branches of a struggle for the liberation of the native Palestinian people from this colonial yoke of Israel. So the escalation, and that we saw, for example, the last week, there were riots in all the Palestine, in several cities, not only in Gaza and West Bank. It was also in Jerusalem, in Haifa, and Yaffa, and Nazareth. And in the occasion of the Ramadan, and even in the occasion of Easter week, Holy Week, the Palestinian native, both Christian and Muslim, were attacked by their respective religious ritual by the colonial fascism. And this is the native people who are revolting against this colonialism, which that's what they have to do. And the solution as a native is to until the abolition of this colonial regime. Mm-hmm.
Well, Susanna, there is no doubt that the so-called Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Zionist, sought to record some sort of an unprecedented achievement for him to leave a detainee, a captive in hunger strike, to leave him to die. This is a first. But in a way that would, in his mind, put some sort of an end to hunger strike that is pursued by the illegally captives, the illegally detained captives in Israeli prisons. Do you think that by killing Sheikh Khidr Adnan, Itamar Ben-Gvir now has ultimately put a halt of similar hunger strikes that can be sought out by captives like Sheikh Khidr?
He, as a fascist, white supremacist person, I think he feel has a sadistic logic in his conception, in this racist and colonial conception. I think he feel happy about what he did. But let me to talk about him, because he doesn't hide his fascist sentiment, his fascist feeling. So Itamar Ben-Gvir says what the other do not say. That they are just as fascist as he is. I would like to put that clear, because it seems to me, Ron, when, for example, many people now, they say that the colonial regime of Israel turned to the right wing. Colonialism is itself right wing and the fascist per se. So why I'm talking about that? Because I see a lot of analyze that say, for example, the arrival of right wing seems to me, for example, when the people start to analyze the arrival of the right wing, it's incoherent for me. It's demagogy. It's even in intellectual emptiness. It's very artificial, because this is a colonial regime. It itself is a fascist. Mm-hmm. So I would like to make clear, when we see no, there is a right wing and in Israel, how come? This is natural, mm-hmm. because we are dealing with the colonial fascist supremacist entity with the need to exterminate the native population. Definitely. And this personality, I'm going to finish with that, this personality, at least he doesn't hide his feeling and his fascist idea, which the other do. And when I see those analysis, what they say, how come the colonial regime of Israel turned to right wing, I think they are making up this, hiding the mm-hmm. real face of this colonialism.
Definitely. When it comes back to the natives, Ms. Susanna, we see them as an occupation, illegal colonial forces on our lands, whether they call themselves right or left, they are a Zionist occupation, yeah. and they will have to leave Palestine. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Susanna Khalil, politologist Thanks. And researcher, columnist and activist, founder of the Kanaan Association. And I know that you are fluent in Spanish, and I wish we could do that in Spanish language to give you the comfort of expressing yourself. But you were absolutely amazing, and I'm always so honored to have you on board, Susanna. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about how the Israeli occupation assassinated Sheikh Khidr Adnan while he was in their captivity. I want to thank you, ladies and gents. I'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The widespread dissatisfaction of UK's patients and also employees working in the British National Health Service, including a significant part of doctors and nurses who are going to resign in protest of the current situation, has put this system at risk of full-scale bankruptcy more than ever. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. The website of Business Telegraph writes, a report revealed more than 160 pharmacies across England have been forced to shut down over the last 2 years due to surging operational costs, staff shortages and scrapped government financial support. According to data from NHS Business Services Authority, the number of community chemists has fallen to a record low since 2015, standing at about 11,000 chemists. Without a chemist, the pharmacy is physically closed, as many rely on a local chemist for advice and to pick up prescriptions. According to the British Pharmacist estimation, there has been a 30% cut in the government's financial support over the last 7 years. After taking account of inflation. Despite the rising patient demand, the pharmacies are still struggling with the obstacles, with the government incapable of handling the crisis across the sector. Meanwhile, this is not the end of a story across the British health system, and the pharmacies are warning that the situation could get worse, with many more local businesses being forced to close without help. Sanjeev Panesar, a pharmacy owner in Birmingham, said the sector is crumbling and is going to fall down like a stack of dominoes if there is not intervention urgently, adding, "Things are in serious jeopardy. It's our worst year ever, where we've made a loss. We have to make some really tough calls and decisions now." Panesar called on political leaders, including Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, to urgently address the issue and relieve the pressure on pharmacies. By the way of background, a 5-year contract was agreed between NHS England and the government in 2019 to support the sector, but pharmacies say it's no match for the rise in prices. Leila Hanbeck, chief executive of the Association of Independent Multiple Pharmacies, said, "We've been left with a contract that doesn't take into account any inflation or any cost of living." She said in an interview recently, "Pharmacies are under a lot of pressure at the moment. All pharmacies are. The cost of medicines is rising. They simply do not have the funding to keep them afloat." The UK National Health Service has recently been grappling with several challenges, with tens of thousands of health staff walking out over a pay dispute with the government. Delayed discharge, bed shortages, a fresh wave of COVID-19 and flu infections, and lack of funds are among the most prominent pressures that the NHS has been facing during the last few months. Repetitive strikes by nurses, ambulance drivers, junior doctors, and other staff across the system have caused staff shortages, which has in turn put the patients' lives at serious risk. Meanwhile, the Evening Standard daily reports nurses across the UK have waged a new strike as part of a protest action by the Royal College of Nursing RNC trade union in what they refer to as their largest work stoppage to date this year, as the cost of living crisis deepens across the country. The strike affected half of the British government's National Health Service, NHS Trust, marking the first time nurses working in A&E, accident and emergency. Intensive care and cancer services have joined the picket lines. The 28-hour strike took place ahead of a crucial meeting between a number of health unions, cabinet ministers and NHS executives recently, when the government's pay offer of 5% was discussed. The Royal College of Nursing, RCN, had earlier rejected the government's wage hike offer and declared this latest strike, which is their third so far this year, in the dispute over pay, recruitment and retention in the NHS. Members of the Unite Union at some NHS trust and ambulance services in England also took part in a strike action after voting to reject the latest pay offer. NHS England also announced that the strike was the largest industrial action so far, warning patients to expect disruptions and delays to services over the strike period. It further warned that the staffing levels for some areas would be exceptionally low, lower than on one previous strike days, and the number of rescheduled appointments as a result of a strike action was due to hit 500,000 in coming days. Meanwhile, Unite members at the Yorkshire Ambulance Service and Guy's and St. Thomas NHS Trust in central London also started a walkout and staged a protest march in central London. Then Unite members at South Central, South East Coast and West Midlands Ambulance Trust, alongside workers at the Christie NHS Foundation Trust and Pathology Partnership, East Lancashire Hospitals NHS Trust and Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust took part in this strike action. Furthermore, The Guardian daily reports Britain's top general practitioner, GP, said patients are developing cancers and enduring so much pain that they cannot climb stairs because of 7.2 million strong waiting list for NHS scans and treatment. Professor Camilla Hawthorne, the chair of the Royal College of GPs, said the record delays for care and uncertainty for patients about when they would finally be seen was leaving people feeling helpless and forgotten. She said these included people with heart problems, those awaiting a hip or knee replacement, and people with potential signs of cancer, whom GPs have said need to be seen urgently. In an interview with The Guardian, she voiced serious concern that some of these patients saw their health deteriorate as a direct result of the delay in accessing hospital care. She said, patients getting sicker while they are on the waiting list is something GPs see and worry about because the risk to the patient is so much greater. It's inevitable that some people stuck will get sicker because that's the nature of illness. Hawthorne, who represents Britain's 50,000 family doctors, called on the NHS to set up an Amazon-style tracking system that would let patients monitor when they would be seen. In an aerial world, the NHS would have a system that would let people track where they are on the waiting list. She added, when we buy something online, we are told, our order been received. When it's ready for dispatch and the date and time it's coming. Something along those lines will help patients understand where they are on the list and help GPs manage their expectations as well. A tracker system would reassure patients who are anxious, worried, and frustrated about when they will finally be seen and help them to negotiate the jungle of the NHS. In addition, it would mean they would no longer need to ask their GP to ring the hospital to find out when their appointment will happen, thus freeing up more appointments slots.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Joe Biden begins his re-election campaign. Donald Trump is trying his luck once again at the presidential elections amid several indictments. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, is another likely contender that will go head-to-head with Trump among the Republicans. As usual, national polls are hard at work, conducting and, more importantly, publishing opinion polls, trying to determine or portray what is on the American public's mind. Joe Biden seems to be getting off to a rough start with his approval ratings at an all-time low and his competitors criticizing him for his competence and old age. Partisan bickering. Gallup has been conducting presidential job approval ratings in the United States since 1937. Now that Joe Biden has started his re-election bid, his approval rating among the U.S. public has gone down to 37%, which is the lowest that Gallup has measured since his inauguration. Biden's approval rating has been in the low 40% range and even at 38% in July for the past 19 months. This last poll was completed the day he announced his re-election. Among the post-World War II U.S. presidents, only Reagan's rating was slightly lower at this point of his presidency. Donald Trump's average rating a year before the elections was 41.6%, and he did not get re-elected.
You recently launched your re-election campaign. You've said questions about your age are legitimate, and your response is always, just watch me. But the country is watching, and recent polling shows that 70% of Americans, including a majority of Democrats, believe you shouldn't run again. What do you say to them? What do you say to those Americans who are watching and aren't convinced? You've said you can beat Trump again. Do you think you're the only one?
I may not be the only one, but I know him well, and I know the danger he presents to our democracy. And we've been down this road before. And with regard to age, you know, and polling data, I notice the polling data I keep hearing about is that I'm between 42% and 46% favorable rating, et cetera. And but everybody running for re-election in this time has been in the same position. There's nothing new about that. You're making it sound like Biden's really underwater.
The United States of America has a long history of political polarization with intense and often bitter conflicts between Republicans and Democrats. The political divide in the country has grown increasingly deep and contentious in recent years, with both parties frequently at odds over key issues in the economy, politics, healthcare, social, and climate matters. Will the elections bring about more friction between Republicans and Democrats?
The elections will definitely inflame tensions on both sides of the aisle in the United States. Between Republicans and Democrats, tensions are always increasing, and that is more so the case as Americans view the stakes to be higher as the global situation becomes more unstable. So, you know, I think that right now in the U.S., there are constantly, brawls between different political factions, whether it be anti-fascists or Proud Boys or just protesters. For example, most policemen are Republicans, and most protesters, most anti-fascist protesters, quote-unquote anti-fascist protesters, are more aligned towards liberal democratic values, and the police are constantly shooting them for protesting and killing them. One protester recently was shot 50-something times and just for simply protesting. So I think that the situation and the political tensions in the U.S. are definitely on, high alert, as it were.
Partisan bickering and infighting have become hallmarks of American politics, with each side often accusing the other of being unreasonable and ideologically extreme. This has led to a breakdown in civility and compromise, with both parties frequently resorting to gridlock and obstructionism to advance their agendas. The result has been a government that is increasingly unable to address the pressing issues facing the country.
Definitely these elections are going to bring more about dividing the country. Unfortunately, the ruling class here in the States has found a way to get away with people paying attention to them, but instead paying attention to each other. So when you have a government that is fueled by a propaganda-style mainstream media that is tied to corporate interests, which is the actual definition of fascism, yes, you're going to get the old school divide and conquer. And this next election cycle, that's all that's on the menu. It's more division among citizens here while pushing aside the important issues that drive our economics and our foreign policy.
Opinion polls play an important role in American politics, particularly in presidential elections. These polls measure public opinion on a range of issues, including candidate favorability, policy preferences, and presidential approval ratings. During presidential campaigns, opinion polls are closely watched as they provide insight into the preferences of the American electorate. Candidates use these polls to gauge their support and adjust their campaign strategies accordingly. What are different polls saying about the 2024 elections?
Recently, there's been a poll released by Emerson that has Biden beating Trump by about 6 points. And beating DeSantis by 2 points. So actually, no, sorry, that's DeSantis by 6 points and Trump by 2 points. So it's pretty close. With polls in the United States and presidential elections, anything can happen at any time. As we've seen in previous elections, there were WikiLeaks coming out that wildly changed the shakeup of the numbers. So I'd say that as of this moment, Biden has the lead. That could change very quickly, though, as more people announce their candidacy. I know that RFK is running now, and Marianne Williamson is running for the Democrats, which could take away from Biden's numbers quite significantly, up to maybe 5 to 10% for each. So I'd say that right now, Biden is winning, but that can change week to week.
Polls are also used by political analysts and the media to track the state of the race and make predictions about the outcome of elections. Following a presidential election, polls shift to measuring the approval ratings of the newly elected president. In recent years, presidential approval ratings have been highly polarized, with a stark partisan divide. This has been particularly evident during the presidencies of Donald Trump and Joe Biden, with approval ratings often heavily influenced by political affiliation.
You know, once again, when people start seeing, like, approval ratings from Biden, and even though they are generally low, a lot of people believe that they should be even lower than they really are. Unfortunately, the way they do conduct a lot of these polls, they can control the narrative. And a lot of times they'll show approval for Joe Biden simply because there's disapproval for the other guy, Donald Trump. However, I don't think that they're going to be able to use these tactics anymore to get them over the top, because people just don't believe that Biden should have anywhere near the approval rating he has. Even though it's traditionally low, they feel the state of the country feels it should be even lower.
Opinion polls have been a source of controversy in American politics, particularly in presidential elections. One major issue with polls is that they can be influenced by a number of factors, including sample size, question wording, and the political leanings of the polling organization. These factors can lead to biased or inaccurate results that do not accurately reflect the preferences of the American electorate. Are polls in America trustworthy?
I do think polls are somewhat trustworthy, but they do have a history of inaccuracy. Most polls are from major firms are generally about 70 to 80, 90% accurate. That being said, things can change very quickly. For example, before Trump announced his first candidacy, he was polling at under 2%. After he announced, he immediately shot up by dozens of points. So I don't think they're predictive. I think they're extremely volatile. And for the most part, polls just serve to bring viewers to mainstream media.
In addition, polls can be subject to manipulation or outright fraud. There have been instances of pollsters intentionally skewing the results in order to influence public opinion or support a particular candidate or party. This has led to concerns about the reliability and validity of opinion polls, particularly in the context of high-stakes presidential elections. Like how most polls in 2016 showed that Hillary Clinton will win the elections, while it turned out to be false.
Well, it's interesting when you look at the polls, because a lot of people don't really trust what the polls are saying anymore. The way they grab these polls are because they call people who have landlines. And most people, young people especially, in America just don't have the old school resources in which they choose to call and gather this information. Polls nowadays, especially in America, seem to just be a way of manipulating data into pushing out certain propaganda to make you believe that the rest of your citizens might be or might be against a certain candidate.
Another controversial issue with presidential opinion polls is their impact on the electoral process itself. Critics argue that polls can have a distorting effect on the election by shaping public opinion, influencing media coverage, and even affecting voter turnout. This can create a self-fulfilling prophecy in which a candidate who is perceived to be winning in the polls becomes even more popular and ultimately wins the election.
You could take the five worst presidents in American history and put them together, and they would not have done the damage Joe Biden has done to our nation in just a few short years, not even close. Thanks to Joe Biden's socialist spending calamity, American families are being decimated by the worst inflation in half a century. Banks are failing, our currency is crashing, and the dollar will soon no longer be the world standard, which will be our greatest defeat in over 200 years. Our cities have been overrun with homelessness, drug addicts, and violent criminals who are being released from jail in mass with no retribution whatsoever while law enforcement is weaponized against law-abiding conservatives or Republicans or people they just don't like.
According to another poll conducted recently by Gallup, more than 4 in 5 Americans are unhappy with the current economic situation. 83% of respondents to the poll described the economic conditions as poor or only fair. Only 16% think conditions are excellent or good, and 72% believe economic conditions are getting worse, while 23% think it is improving. What are the most important factors for voters in 2024?
The most important factor, unfortunately, in the United States happens to be all about the culture wars. People are divided amongst social issues in the United States, unlike other countries where they might pay more attention to their foreign policy, definitely pay more attention to their manufacturing and their economics. Americans are just so caught up on the things that really don't matter in arenas that matter in other countries and really should be more about, you know, highlighting those issues here. Unfortunately, people will be arguing more about guns, more about trans issues, more about gay rights, more about pronouns, more about those issues in which really don't matter to economics or matter to our foreign policy, which equates to who we decide can live or breathe on this planet via proxy war, hot war, sanctions, and banking loans to countries that really lock them down.
It's no wonder that Biden is receiving his lowest approval rating. In the poll by Gallup, a third of respondents cited economic problems as the number one issue the country is facing at the moment, with the high cost of living and inflation as their highest concern. Other non-economic concerns most common among respondents were the government and its poor leadership, immigration, unifying the country, and crime or violence. Surprisingly, crime and violence was only the main concern of just 3% of respondents.
I think the most important factor for voters in 2024 is 100% the economy. The economy in the U.S. is out of control. The inflation is skyrocketing. It's something like $80 for just a bag of groceries. Rent prices are skyrocketing. Healthcare is extremely expensive. So I think that's the number one issue. And both candidates, or all candidates, are going to have their own, you know, pitches to the American public on how to resolve that. Unfortunately, it seems like not very much is going to change. Inflation has gone down a bit, but multiple banks have collapsed recently and been seized by the U.S. government. So the situation is quite dire, and it seems like with the sort of the collapse of U.S. dollar hegemony on the horizon, that the situation is just going to get worse. The homeless situation is especially bad. So I think that that Americans are rightly concerned about the economy.
Now, with more than a year left to the 2024 presidential race, polls are at it again. According to WPA Intelligence, examining 7 national vote polls since mid-February, Donald Trump would lose to Biden by an average of 3.1%, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis would win the popular vote over Biden by an average of 1.2%. Based on these polls, if the elections were held today, Donald Trump would lose to Joe Biden. Is the U.S. united or more divided?
Unfortunately, when it comes to United States citizens being united, they can sometimes emulate what our Congress does. They can be united when it comes to intervention. They can be united when it comes to war. They can be united with proxy wars against other countries. Unfortunately, where the United States people are united comes from a very bad foreign policy and a thought process that it was, you know, birthed from the Monroe Doctrine that the United States military and foreign policy apparatus has the right to go around and police the planet. That's the only area in which our Congress is united, and that's the only area in which our citizens are united. Now, that's a small amount of citizens that are united, the people on the fray. But the people behind closed doors, I think a lot of Americans are growing tired of our foreign policy and tired of not just wasting so much money, but so many lives. So I think there is a unification on both fronts for and against war. But unfortunately, they only show the parties that are united for war, and they silence the parties who are against war.
A new Wall Street Journal poll on the 2024 presidential election reveals more than half of American voters viewed both the current and former presidents very unfavorably. This is while among Republicans, Ron DeSantis is trailing Donald Trump by 13 points, 51-38%. 70% of respondents in an NBC News poll said they did not want Biden to run for re-election, and 60% said the same about Donald Trump.
The United States is not united at all. The name is somewhat ironic at this point. People are, constantly engaging in sort of a culture information war over things like social rights, abortion. Half the country is divided on both of those. Gun laws. There are people getting murdered, mass murdered every day. School children getting murdered every week, it seems. So I think that the United States is very much not divided. And even people more radical than sort of Democrats and Republicans are not united in any way at all. And unfortunately, it seems like that, too, is going to continue to get worse. I do believe that one thing that could help bring people together is, ironically, a fall of the economy, because people's priorities are not very much in order right now. And when they become less comfortable, it's easier to find common ground.
Fox News survey shows Donald Trump's advantage in the 2024 Republican presidential nomination race, since support for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is slipping. The survey also reveals that Joe Biden is supported by 62% of Democratic primary voters, while Robert Kennedy Jr. is far behind at 19% and Williamson is at just 9%. In the Republican camp, Trump has 53%. DeSantis, 21%, Mike Pence, 6%, and Nikki Haley at 4%.
The next election really is a recipe for disaster. People in the media and in the government like to play up January 6th as if it was an actual insurrection. Being there myself, I can tell you it was not. People were just starting to peek, look inside the window, the door, or whatever analogy you want to use, at our elections. And that's what that was all about. That's why there was so much of a heavy pushback from the government and our media about this whole situation, because they don't want our citizens looking into our elections ever again. Also, they want to take advantage of a crisis and put more restrictions on our civil liberties. And why would they let that go to waste? But this particular election has a lot more at stake, because people have called BS, which means bull, you know what. And they think that our election system hasn't gotten any better. In fact, there's a lot of people who think it's gotten worse. So let's not even talk about January 6th. If they cheat this next election, they might see something unprecedented like they've never seen before.
Fox News national survey shows higher approval ratings for Biden than the Gallup poll. In the survey, Biden's job performance rating held somewhat steady for more than a year at 44% approving and 56% disapproving of his performance. In the survey, 53% disapprove on national security, 54% on foreign policy, 60% on border security, and 64% disapprove of how he is handling the U.S. economy.
I think it's extremely likely that there are multiple crises that occur as a result of the increase of tensions, whether it's on the same level as people going into the Capitol building is a different story. But I do believe that it's only a matter of time until an event like that or an event similar to that happens again. And it could happen during the course of the presidential elections. People are very discontent with how things are. And it seems like both sides of the political spectrum are just interested in maintaining the status quo. And if that's the case, as I mentioned earlier, the economy is getting worse. People are very concerned about the threat of World War III. Fortunately, the Republicans are, some of them are trying to de-escalate the situation, starting to question why we're sending so much money to Ukraine, which is another very important